Hey Junkions, this episode is brought to you by Fun Size Horror, a free online platform for original and user-submitted horror shorts. Because if there's one thing horror fans know, it's that if we can't find good stuff in the theaters, we're going to take it in the shorts. If you're a filmmaker looking for a place to share your film and grow your audience, go to funsizehorror.com. Submitted films can be eligible for promotions, contests, and distribution. Follow Fun Size Horror on Twitter, at Fun Size Horror, and like them on Facebook, also at Fun Size Horror, conveniently enough. And stay up to date on the latest releases, contests, and promotions. Hey everybody, this episode is also brought to you by Rogue One, out on Blu-ray. From Lucasfilm comes the first of the Star Wars standalone films, Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, an epic adventure. If you don't know what it's about, you know those Death Star plans? People want them, and other people are trying to get them. The Blu-ray comes with the Blu-ray disc, DVD, digital copy, and more special features than you can shake a droid at. More cushion for the pushing. I don't know. We haven't workshopped the jokes for this one. Star Wars fans and those nerdy for the Dirty Dozen need Rogue One in their collection. The Disney Blu-ray is out today. Buy it from our links on the FSR page to support the show. Star Wars!
This is Junk Food Cinema. Across the sky.
And that is exactly why I record the mic test. Welcome, everybody, to an exciting new episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmSchoolRejects.com.
Meet me halfway.
I will always.
Across this guy.
Okay, yeah, no, I'm okay with it.
There are three of us here.
There are three of us here. This is the weekly cult and exploitation film cast that is so good, it just has to be fattening. I'm your host, Brian Salisbury. He's C. Robert Cargill. And you've already heard the voice, the dulcet tones of our special guest for this episode. Returning, a returning champion.
Our first returning guest.
Returning guest, programmer for the Alamo Drafthouse, creative director at Neon Films, the grizzly to my bull. Greg McLennan.
How do you do? I did not know that I was going to be the first repeat customer. I feel deeply honored. Also, an embarrassment of riches when I'm here, because you guys exclusively invite me whenever it's just my favorite films of all time.
Well, usually it comes to, we have the conversation where we say, well, let's cover this movie. And then he says, you do realize Greg will break my arm if I do not bring him on this episode.
You are the first guest to threaten me with physical violence if I didn't have you on for this particular movie, which we'll get to in just a second. But first, I want to let you guys know that our back catalog is available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. We have fancy new Amazon links, by the way. So if you like the movies we're talking about, you're like, man, I need to buy that and watch it and see what the fuck these guys are talking about. Or if you're like, I really need a giant month supply of ramen noodles. Great news. No matter what you buy, if you use our Amazon links to get to Amazon, anything you buy, we get a kickback from. So we really do appreciate that. And if you want to kick back even more, you can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema and put a couple shekels into the hat. This is a great time to become a patron. We've got a lot of great stuff this summer, including Summer of 77, a completely separate running series just for patrons, where we're going to examine our favorite movies from 1977, running right under our favorite films from 1987. So just a great time to be a patron all the way around. Well, we're continuing through One Junkie Summer, or I guess, you know what, I guess we should call it maybe Another Junkie Summer, since this is our second run at this.
Well, since it's Summer of 87, it's got to be One Junkie Summer 2.
Oh, yeah, that's a good
point. I'm a big fan of using numericals, because then people don't get confused about what order to go in.
Oh, that's true. So this shouldn't be like One Junkie Summer : Resurrection either, right?
Yeah, no.
Because I can't follow those fucking Resident Evil movies. I don't know.
I didn't even get that was a reference. That is how confused that titling is.
Just a colon and then an RE title, like Retribution, Resurrection, Redistribution. I don't know how it works. But today is the realization of a dream. And it's a dream I never thought would come true.
Yeah, it's a dream you've been pushing for quite some time.
Oh, but I am not a man to give up on his dreams, because this is a movie.
That is correct. That is probably the most truthful thing.
We're letting you do this. Have fun with your friends.
Yeah, it's the most truthful thing that will probably be said about this movie tonight. It is, in fact, a movie.
You could say that Cargill and I have been wrestling over this one for a while because I have wanted to cover it, and he does not share my affinity for it. But today we're going to see if, like a trucker hat on Lincoln Hawk, we can turn him around on Over the Top.
Has always bet against Lincoln Hawks.
This guy's nothing.
Why'd you leave us?
It won't happen again.
But a winner never listens to the odds.
Where would we end up?
Together is all I can guarantee.
You ain't got a prayer in Vegas.
You never had anything, so you have nothing to lose.
All I want to do is hurt him, cripple him, get him off the table.
All I care about is you. You're my boy, you understand?
The world beats nobody halfway. Now is the time to do for yourself.
I owe you.
Over the top, Dad, over the top.
Come on.
Sylvester Stallone, Over the Top.
Yeah.
Get excited! At least you're passionate about it.
Yeah, no, I've honestly got to say, though, I saw this film 25 years ago, easily, if not a little longer than that, and I had not seen it since, and it's that Stallone film that it's like, oh, God, that movie. And rewatching it last night, I don't hate this movie.
Yay! In
fact, there's a lot to, like, dare I say, love about this movie that, yeah, it definitely turned me around. I do not hate this film. I am glad we're talking about it because there's things both good and bad to talk about this film. It is an interesting, it's a very interesting little nugget of cinema history we have here.
That Death of Cannon Films.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, yes. So much to dig into with
that. Yeah. This is, and the names, the amount of talent that's attached to a film that is so slight and is so ill regarded is strange.
And possibly you could say ill conceived.
I would not say ill conceived.
Oh, but it is. It is. I love this movie to death, but it is the perfect storm of hubris when you have a producer like Menachem Golan and an actor like Sylvester Stallone coming together, two people who are known for letting their egos run wild. And we mentioned Cannon Films. If you haven't seen the documentary Electric Boogaloo, I highly recommend you give that a spin to really understand the depth of insanity that was this studio. A studio that for a while, just to give you an example, just a dip into the pool, they had for a while, their script readers had two piles. The Chuck piles, one for Chuck Norris, one for Charles Bronson. No matter what the script was that came in, you put the scripts in one of those two piles.
And then it would filter its way out in other ways.
Yeah.
The thing you have to keep in mind about Cannon is Cannon was essentially the Blumhouse of the 80s. It was its own small sub-studio as a production house.
But without any of the rules.
Blumhouse's
got some rules.
If Jason Blum was a total shyster, yes.
Well, that's the thing is Blum actually has a model that works, and it is a functioning model that churns out a lot of very interesting stuff. And some of the stuff is really awesome, and some of the stuff just doesn't work. This is Cannon. Cannon was very much like that. Like we would, you know, you'd see the Cannon logo and you kind of get excited because you know, as a kid in that era, you're like, whatever I'm going to see, it's going to be fucking crazy and hopefully awesome. And sometimes it really was. Sometimes you'd get some real amazing Cannon gems from the 80s.
My fourth.
Oh, God, yes. And then there's some real big turd monkeys, like some terrible, terrible films.
Like Going Bananas featuring one of the stars of this movie. and a little person in an ape costume that for some reason at the end of the film decides it can talk. I don't know. That's just one example of what's going on with Cannon films.
Sell it better. It's a dynasty. If you saw the logo, it was more or less a sign of quality that no matter what you were going to see, you were going to be satisfied.
Yes, more or less,
yeah. Sure. And you'd end up with stuff like something we need to cover here in the future: Invasion USA.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Chuck pile.
Yeah, the Chuck pile. I have to share.
That's going to become a new catchphrase on this show.
The Chuck Pile. Throw another one on the Chuck Pile. Yeah, I have to share this. I shared this on Twitter, so some of you may have seen this already. But so I went to rent this movie last night on Amazon, and it's one of those things where you could tell some copy editor could not give two shits about their job. And literally, here is the description on Amazon. Some fight for money, some fight for glory. He's fighting for his son's love. Sylvester Stallone blends action with sentimentality in this family. And that's it. There's a period there.
He was really more of a copy in this family. And didn't do his job all the way through.
Yeah, it's
that just sounds like the DVD company who like sold to Amazon, like didn't pay attention to the character limits.
They really did not.
As someone who owns this on Blu-ray, I can tell you, the Blu-ray does not put any more care into it as that description.
It
does.
It opens on a jiggly Warner Brothers logo, and yeah. If you go to your extras and it says trailers, and then you go to the trailers, it just has a trailer for this movie.
It's really just trailer singular.
So it didn't meet you halfway?
No, it meant none of
it
us.
It had
halfway.
The movie in high def, and that was enough for me. It was
the very fact that they made a Blu-ray of Over the Top astounds me. But
as sweaty as this movie is in high definition, everyone glistens like a glazed donut. It is fucking crazy. The amount of like flexing going on in the third act of this movie alone. It is glorious in all 1080p.
Do you need to put the nitro back in the box?
Put the nitro back in the box.
Would it dumbfound you to know that they made a 70mm print of this movie?
Oh my god!
So I did the thing. I do Tough Guy Cinema at Alamo Drafthouse, and we did a marathon called the Stallone Zone. And for the big finale finisher, I couldn't keep the myth. So they're always mystery movies. And so the last movie, I had to let people know in advance what it was because we had to do a 30-minute changeover to switch over to 70mm, and I found what I can assume to believe is the only 70mm print of Over the Top, and it was exclusively made in 70mm, not because you needed to have that incredible definition, nor was it shot on a 70mm, but it had those 6 mag tracks that just like blow your eardrums with perfection of listening to this soundtrack.
We are going to talk about this soundtrack, don't you worry. I was actually at that event because I can... And
you
as
have
I,
the hat from the event.
I do have the hat from the event. As I was sitting there watching it, I could hear Menachem Golan in the background just being like, no, it has to be as big as possible. The only way this movie is good is if it's big. Everyone can see how big the arm wrestling is. And it's just like,
put
yeah.
more sweat on them.
More sweat.
Everyone.
Spritz them all. And that's pretty much how he operated all the time. He had a Joe DiMaggio-like streak of misunderstanding American culture that is just second to none. I mean, if you look at the canon films and the things they tried to capitalize on that weren't really things, I mean, you like, breakdancing was probably the closest they got with the breaking movies. But then they also released a Lambada movie because people are really into Lambada, right?
Oh, we were really into Lambada for 3 minutes.
By the time his movies came out, the crazes were over. It's a Saturday Night Fever conundrum. And the biggest swing and a miss for my money is that, no, arm wrestling is the biggest sport in the world. It's not just that it's popular in his imagination. It's that it's on at airports. There are trade shows attached to the arm wrestling championships. And there are people who will travel from all over the country just to win a big rig truck, which to me is like, congratulations, you're the best at this thing. Now go be a truck driver to support yourself.
Stereotyping.
Yeah, it's like, go be a trucker to support yourself because obviously this is the only arm wrestling competition in the world ever once, so it's not as popular as you are already professing that it is.
I mean, in rewatching it last night and in having seen like a lot of Stallone movies, have you guys ever seen the movie Paradise Alley?
I actually have not.
No. So it's the first movie that Stallone ever wrote, directed, and starred in, but it was released after Rocky. And it's about him and his two brothers living in New York. Like one's like an ice delivery man. And anyways, it's kind of Rocky, kind of over the top, but it's about like club wrestling. So like dudes who basically were doing WWF, but it was supposed to be real in the movie. But it has like a really...
Wrestling is real.
It's a really incredible movie.
Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about.
I think it takes place in like the... It's either the 30s or the 50s, but it's like a depressed time where, like, you know, it's like he plays like that everyman and like he rises.
What?
Up.
Sylvester Stallone plays an everyman?
Well, what's incredible is he gave the role of the like champion wrestler to his brother in the movie, and he is his manager. And so Stallone takes a back seat to that, like, starring role.
Put that on your calendar. That's the last fucking time that's ever going to happen.
He also sings the title song.
Not the last time that's going to happen, as this movie will tell you.
I don't think he's ever sang again for a title track.
No, well, he is actually on the title track of this song. And but there's a reason for that, and that's something I want to touch on right now, is that if you are unfamiliar with the clout and the flexing of muscles, and I'm not talking about an arm wrestling competition, that happens with Stallone throughout his career. Here's a great example. I don't know if I told this story before, but Demolition Man. They're preparing for the scene in the opening where they walk John Spartan down the hallway to be frozen in prison. And Stallone, and I got this directly from someone who worked on this movie. Stallone takes a look at the actors playing the guards and notices that they're both taller than he is, has them both fired, lines up everyone in the crew against the wall, and picks two grips that are shorter than him, because God forbid anyone in a Stallone movie be bigger than Stallone. That's the kind of, or better example from our Cobra episode, when he tried to convince the writer of the book that Cobra is based on to let Stallone re-release the book with his own name listed as the author just because he wrote the screenplay for the movie. That's the kind of Stallone we're talking about. And on this movie, this is a movie that he didn't want to do. And he is famously quoted as saying he hates the movie, and the only reason he did it is because every time he said no, Menachem Golan offered him more money. And eventually he said, yeah, I'll take the money. It's not like anyone's going to see this.
Yeah, he says, isn't there a great quote about that?
It's not like anyone's going to see one of the biggest films canon ever released. And despite that disinterest, he still wrote the script. He still changed the original draft of the story so much that the writer was pissed. And threw Asia, the band, off their own title soundtrack because he thought the lead singer's voice was too wussy. Put Sammy Hagar in there and sang with Sammy Hagar on the fucking title track. Stallone.
Cocaine is a hell of a drug.
Which is weird because, like, there's that dichotomy of, like, that, like, private 80s, like, coked out, muscle bound Stallone that everybody kind of, like, assumes that they know something about. But I think, like, what's so incredible about him as, like, a writer, director, actor is he does latch on to these, like, everyman roles, and, like, he doesn't play, like, these, like, superhuman people. Like, he had this, like, arc where, like, the 90s he kind of turned into that superhuman man, but whenever he was starting out, like, he plays, like, kind of, like, the lovable schlub and, like, wants people to relate to him on that level. And it's
true.
And it's weird to, like, think about, like, this guy who's like, oh, get the shorter guys in the room, whenever simultaneously you can see literally this man's fractured ego on screen because, like, Schwarzenegger is incredible, like, Van Damme's wonderful, but, like, whenever you watch a Stallone movie, there's, like, this, like, deep-seated earnestness that I think keeps you from hating a movie like Over the Top. Like, I understand people who don't like this movie, but I don't understand people who can't even remotely think that it's earnest, because, like, I just feel like there's, like, a real, like, he's opening up his heart and going, are you guys getting what I'm putting out? Because it's not, like, a complex puzzle.
No.
But, like, all of the pieces are there. Are you seeing, like, who's inside? And I think he was just, like, always kind of, like, exercising that through his art in a way, which made him such an interesting kind of action hero.
Yeah.
And then whenever he started to kind of be rejected by that, by, like, the Rocky Fives, is whenever he started to, you know, do, like, the Demolition Mans and the Judge Dredds, where he's just like, I'm an unstoppable, like, muscle-bound force, if that's what you guys want from me. If that's what you put together.
I'm going to decide to be Judge Dredd but take the helmet off because everyone needs to see my mug on screen, even though that's fundamentally disrespectful to the character who never took the helmet off. Don't worry about it. But you're right. In fact, one of the things I wrote down is that there's a sincerity to, I mean, Lincoln Hawk is a dumb character. I mean, he's basically a pile of beefsteak, but there's such a sincerity to him that you can't help but love him, especially since, well, let me get into the plot a little bit before I go too far
wait,
off the rails.
Wait, the what?
You
do
heard
we,
me.
Do we presuppose that people know the plot?
I feel like a lot of people haven't seen Over the Top.
I think the greatest misconception for this movie is people go, isn't that the one where Stallone arm wrestles for the custody
thank
of his
you.
Son?
And you're right.
And you go, no. It's no, that one. Is not what it's about. No,
that has, it's that not. Has nothing to do with that at all, actually.
Because, and God, no, we'll get to that. So the story as it is that Lincoln Hawk, played by Sylvester Stallone, is a struggling truck driver who, at the beginning of the movie, we see him obviously in his best denim and suspenders going to the military prep school that his son is currently graduating from some grade. I don't know how military schools work.
I'm assuming
work.
It was like middle school graduation.
Yeah,
like 12.
That sounds about right. But you get the sense immediately that this kid and his father, Lincoln Hawk, have not seen each other ever. Like, this kid is very apprehensive about Stallone being in the room. By the way, I'd be apprehensive, too, if my first name was Michael and my father's last name was Hawk, because that effectively makes my name Mike Hawk. Come on, screenwriters! Anticipate this shit. So what happens is Stallone tells...
So Stallone is arm wrestling for Mike Hawk?
For Mike Hawk, yes. Get your hands off Mike Hawk is something you hear throughout this entire movie when they try to kidnap the kid. He's been living with his grandfather, played by Robert Loggia. And
you're a goddamn bum.
You're a goddamn bum! I just sound like Mick. I feel like in every Stallone movie, there has to be one gravelly voice guy.
Gravelly, older, respected actor who calls Stallone a bum.
Yes, absolutely. So Mike's been living with his grandfather. His mother is very sick and decides, cooks up this plan for the estranged father, Lincoln, and young Mike to reacquaint by driving across the country to come see her. Again, Mike's very apprehensive, but eventually realizes he has to go along. Spends the entire trip basically second-guessing whether Stallone is his father and insulting his intelligence and being generally a prick. If there's one thing that has not aged well with this movie, and every time I watch it I have this thought, fuck this kid. Oh my crom, yeah, he's, fuck this kid.
He's the kid from the toy. Yeah. You're just like, fuck that kid.
Yes, absolutely.
I don't care if you learn a life lesson. You're growing up a piece of shit.
The best thing that ever happened to you was being pseudo-abducted by this truck driver.
Yeah, I was going to say, the best you can hope for is you're going to grow into your size.
That your stature will catch up with your mouth at some point. So they're going across the country, and one of the things that Mike discovers is that his father has a hobby. And that hobby is to go to truck stops and engage in illegal gambling over arm wrestling at these truck stops. Funny enough...
Is it a hobby or is he just trying to eat?
I don't know. I don't really know.
He's just trying to pay for his wife's medical bills.
I guess that's what it is, even though her father's rich. So that
No, they actually do a really good job of establishing what he's doing with all the money. He wants to start up a business.
No, he definitely wants to start up a business. He wants to have his own trucking firm because this is a very blue-collar, you know, likable character. And what I find so hilarious about this is... he is so mild-mannered and sweet. He puts up with all of Mike's shit throughout this whole movie. But the minute he gets into an arm wrestling contest, when that hat flips around backwards, he has an intensity that you don't see in the fucking Rocky movies. It is insane. Like, not even in the Rambo movies. Like, he is just like a beast all of a sudden.
Yeah, it's a fun factor. That very first arm wrestling match at the diner... He arm wrestles a guy called Smasher.
The Smasher. I'm the Smasher. That's how he introduces
who's
himself.
Who's played by Magic Schwartz, who is an Austin local. And if you've ever seen a movie called Stone Cold.
Oh, my God. With yes, the boss, Ryan Bosworth.
He's in that movie, but he's also the guy that designed the stunt that launched the motorcycle into the helicopter.
Nice.
But yeah, he came. Like, I showed Stone Cold with Brian Bosworth one time, and he came out just to say, hey... and he gave me like his email address and like a signed glossy, and like his email address was like professionalbaddude@hotmail.com or something. But yeah, like he fought Van Damme and Lionheart. Like, he was always just like oh, we need a fucking lunatic. On the racquetball court in Lionheart. And I was like, yeah, we need a fucking lunatic that looks like super muscly. He's got tattoos and could fight these like titans of cinema. And Magic Schwartz was always the guy that like got the shit beat out of him by professional tough guys.
He is a lunatic. The one thing I will not judge him for is that before a match, he has somebody standing there slapping him in the fucking face to get him pumped up. And I wanted to call that out and be like, what a lunatic. And then I remembered
that... Everybody does that.
Well, then I remembered Fantastic Fest and how Slapshots became a thing a few years ago.
Slapshots was a thing.
Slapshots, if you're not aware, because you shouldn't be, because you're a rational human being, is where you stand across from someone, you take a shot, they slap you in the face, they take a shot, you slap them in the face. There is no point.
And
there's no
hug,
objective.
And then you hug.
You hug. There's no one wins except everybody wins, and it's magical. And it's the worst thing ever. And do it immediately. Don't do it. So this is where Mike learns that his father has this this acumen for winning at arm wrestling using this technique where he basically wraps all of his fingers across the top of the fist of the other competitor, and it's called going over the top, and that's how he wins. That's his big secret. This all leads to the arm wrestling, I'm going to try and say this with a straight face, World Championships in Las Vegas, where the prize is $100,000 cash and a big rig. You win $100,000 and you win a truck.
I thought it was like $500,000, some stupid. No, I guess it is $100,000.
Because he was a 20-to-1 and he bets on himself.
Yeah.
So he sweetened the pot for himself.
So that's kind of, and throughout this process, throughout him trying to get to this competition, he's also dealing with the fact that Robert Loggia, as Mike's grandfather, is desperately trying to take custody away from Lincoln Hawk because they just don't get
well,
along.
Kind of.
Yeah,
I mean,
custody and like kidnapping or
the thing is that his wife, his ex-wife is very sick. She has custody of Mike, and then halfway through the movie, an operation goes wrong. She dies, and Robert Loggia is desperately trying to find a way to get custody of Mike because legally it would transfer to Lincoln Hawk.
Yeah, and he's even, and this is where I want to put to bed a long-standing myth about this movie that we've already touched upon, because many people refer to this as the movie where Sylvester Stallone arm wrestles for custody of his son. My problem with that statement is not so much that it's reductive as it's totally inaccurate, because he has custody the entire time. He never loses custody. In fact,
signs over custody.
Right, because one of Loggia's goons actually tells Loggia during the movie, there is no judge in the country that will award you custody over the biological father. Basically telling him, we're fucked. But then, that same goon visits Stallone and says, if you try to take custody... Robert Loggia kidnaps the kid. And then the goon has the balls to tell Stallone, if you try to take him back, you won't win. We have the best lawyers. That's great that you have the best lawyers, but you also have no legal grounds for this. It's a real Donald Trump move. I have no authority to do this. I am not in the right, but I will bully you into thinking that my lawyers can find a way to make it happen, and you'll just go away.
And that is, the setup of him as the villain in this film. And it leads to one of the moments in this movie that does not age well, which is when...
Oh, I'm listening now.
Yeah. No, because...
Hey, meet him halfway, okay?
Societally, like in this day and age, could you imagine if I put that scene in a movie now where a dad goes to get his son who was kidnapped by a grandfather and the police come and arrest him and the words do not come out of his mouth, they have my son.
Yeah.
At that point, like, you know, in the 80s, it's a little...
Admittedly, he did go about it in the wrong way to where he could have accepted that arrest. He's going like, oh, fair enough, guys.
I would disagree. Like, I would say that, you know, he went up, he tried to get in normally. They denied him access. They were keeping the son, to which... they do not have any legal right, and he went into he trespassed, but he trespassed to get his son, which no police officer in their right mind, anyone who's done custody things at all, they'll tell you it is not, those things are not fun, but you have to be very careful about what you do because that blows back on the police officers if they do not do
that. Makes it a poor aging movie in the conceit of I am a 1987 truck driver and I've gone about reclaiming my son in an inappropriate way, and then the cops come because of how I've gone about it. Because I don't want to spoil this part for anybody who's not seen the movie. But like, whenever the cops come, I'm pretty sure he's just like, fuck. Like, I got baited, I took the bait, and now I fucked myself.
And that's possible, too. It should be stated, however, that what this movie does well, that I feel like Real Steel, which... blatantly rips this off.
They're exact scene.
They're the same fucking
frames. Like working out on the truck. I'm just like, this is an exact scene.
But what Real Steel does wrong that this movie gets right is this movie never makes Stallone anything but lovable. Like your heart goes out to him the whole time, even when he's strangely forcing his child to engage in gambling and arm wrestling with kids that are twice his size. You still love him the whole time. Hugh Jackman's a piece of shit in Real Steel who tries... Imagine if at the beginning...
You have a whole rant about Hugh Jackman.
Imagine if at the beginning of Over the Top...
He's like a rant about Real Steel here.
Oh, yes.
I don't need a fucking excuse to rant about this movie. Imagine if at the beginning of Over the Top, instead of being like, I want to connect with my son and I'm really excited to get to drive across the country with him, the first thing Stallone did was try to sell a child for money. Because that's the first thing Hugh Jackman does in Real Steel, and they expect us to still be on his side. Go fuck yourself.
He's Hugh Jackman, though. He's so likable.
No, not in that movie. I'm sorry. What he does isn't pretty in that movie. Let's just put it that way. But in this movie, the villains are a small child and a woman with cancer who is dying. Because the weirdest part about, and I just want to say this right off the bat, this is not a good movie, but
it's just the best movie.
It's a great movie. Like, it's so, if you were to chart out, like, if one axis is how bad the movie is and the other axis is how much I love it, we're talking like top right quadrant right here.
Well, the interesting thing about this movie is how basic it is. I'm fascinated.
Oh, yeah. It's a Van Damme. It's a Seagal.
Well, it's, but it's, you can actually look, you can see all the building blocks put in place to make this movie. There's no further development of those blocks. Everything is very simple.
They don't all necessarily fit together, these blocks.
The villains, no, they do. The villains are one-dimensional. They just serve a purpose to the plot. There is no complication to any of the characters at all. The most complication we get out of any character is this mystery as to why Sylvester Stallone left.
The other thing that makes me say that this isn't a great movie, it's a little slapdash, the blocks don't all fit. What is the main character's name?
Lincoln? Hawk?
Hawk?
Hawk.
Really? Because at 15 points during this movie, they refer to him as Hawks. It goes back and... if you watch this movie and you listen...
That's
to
That's Hawk's truck.
They're saying...
I think you're just making fun of poor people now.
No, he says...
You classist son of a bitch.
What are the odds on Lincoln Hawks? Hey, are you Hawks? Hawk can't support him. It goes back and forth because...
Probably just a nickname.
It's not a nickname. It is a quintessential Golden and Globus production.
I thought you were going to pull up
You know
back.
What? If they made a movie out of our lives, what is that character's name? Is it McLennan or McClenahan?
No, nobody knows.
See, that's a fault on our part. That's all I'm saying.
I get emails from people that misspell my name, and my last name is in my email address.
Yeah, there's not a lot of people.
I actually had a moment today where my keyboard stuck, and I misspelled my own last name in an email I sent out to a bunch of work folks. So I was like, oh, God damn it, Carkill. I guess I just have to change my name now. Oh, yeah, by the way, honey, we're legally changing our name so I don't have to face the humiliation.
That is a quintessential Cargill move. I'm not wrong. We're changing our names. I can't be wrong. Therefore, let's go file the paperwork to change our
names. I understand faults with this movie, but it doesn't mitigate my love for it.
Oh, mine either.
I'm just trying to pull it. But like the thing is if you like just, and like you were talking about the parts in there, and all of the parts are put in, and if you look at the parts kind of like objectively without like thinking about how much you like or dislike over the top, that movie is a like 47-minute drama and a 40-minute awesome arm wrestling movie.
Yeah.
And like literally they just kind of pepper in the arm wrestling just to let you know, they're like, don't worry, arm wrestling's coming. And then the last 45 minutes are just like, okay, now it's all arm wrestling.
Oh yeah,
the drama's done at this point.
It takes an hour to get to the arm wrestling. Like there's the one arm wrestling at the truck stop and
just
then
so you know, you came to the right movie.
Mike arm wrestles a kid. That's all there is in the first hour. So when you call this the arm wrestling movie,
right,
you mean the arm wrestling, the movie with the arm wrestling third act, because there is not arm wrestling in the first act.
Hyper masculine movie that guys like to watch because it can tap into the emotionality that they have like brewing beneath the surface.
Well, and it's also, you know, it plays upon all these very simple ideas of like, here is this big, strong guy. I'm not as big or as strong as him, but I have the will to beat him. And that is very much it's very much the whole concept of the 80s is the little guy, the David and Goliath story, the little guy beating the big guy. They even mention that. They go so far as to tell us it's a David and Goliath story. It's like,
yeah,
that's
actually contractually obligated. Sylvester Stallone's like, you got to say that at least once.
Well, it's not just like Rocky. It's Hawky. It's Hawky 4, where he's going up against a giant, because the guy that he arm wrestles at the end of this movie is the size of a bulldozer.
Yeah, he is gigantic. That might be
why his name is Bull. I don't know.
One of the things I found really fascinating about this is there is a filmmaking technique they do in this movie that was not common in the 80s and works so effectively here. It's been done so many times since that it seems...
Switching to the documentary.
And
you saw it again, like in Balboa, like at the end, whenever they kind of shoehorned in the like live HBO broadcast,
holy
and you're just like
shit.
Stallone, like I swear to God, Stallone did this. He's just like, how can we pepper in more character?
Whoa.
And like that acting that Stallone does, like, is so naturalistic and like Brando style, where he's just like, you know, like I turn into like one of these, like I'm a like I'm a machine. And like he says stuff, yeah. But like you see it and you go like, well, that line doesn't work on a page, but whenever you see him delivering it in that moment, you go, fuck, man.
And all of and we set up all of our antagonists in the third act this way so elegantly.
Yeah.
And all of them do great. They all pull double duty as, you know, the real movie version of these, and then seeing them as real people on a reality style interview.
What is the cut to after, like, the guy's like, he's like, I just want to beat that guy out there. And then, like, it cuts to, like, the guy, like, drinking, like, the canned motor oil. And you go, you're not a real person. But you even get a denouement for that guy. Because, like, after Stallone beats him, he likes fucking eating Rolaids in, like, the crowd afterwards.
Yeah. He's got to down some Alka-Seltzer because, as it turns out, motor oil's not good for you.
I will say one of the nice touches, and I don't know if this was a, like, victim of circumstance or what, but it's the first time that I noticed this. And maybe it's a small detail, but it kind of just, like, fully, like, articulated the earnestness and like the sweet kind of nature of Stallone. The shirt that he wears to his son's graduation at the beginning, where he puts on the tie with, but it's got like a bleach stain on it and shit, and you're like, well, he's trying, is the exact same shirt that he shows up to the championships with, but the sleeves are off of it, going like, this is all I got.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm here, shirt on my back. And it's just like a stupid little thing, but I felt like it was so like effective.
Yeah, it really is. Like, there is some. That's the thing about Golan, is that he really tried as a director. Like, he was known as
some like handheld camera work where they're like whipping around the truck and like doing like dolly-ins and stuff. And I was like, that's like three techniques in one.
He was known as a schlockmeister as a producer. But whenever he made a movie, like we covered one of his movies very early on. Last American Virgin. And he was a genuine fucking filmmaker. Like, he tried. He like fucking went out there and left it all out on the field. Whether the movies work or not is a completely different thing, but he was trying to make good movies. This is not an Uwe Boll situation.
Well, yeah, it's like, I mean, I don't want to say like Quentin Tarantino in the same breath, but like in the sense
but
that
you just did.
Quentin Tarantino like could hear movies and like speaks the language of movies. I think that Menelem Golan had obviously a handicap probably in that department, where he understood like structure. Like, there are three acts. There's a bad guy and there's a good guy, but that's about it. But I think there was like a visual language that was like learned from like constantly, because he was such a movie fan that he's just like, oh, I saw this cool thing with a camera. And most people don't necessarily see that. They just go like, oh, that was neat, or like that felt really intense. And I think he was one of those people that just like spoke that visual language.
Yeah, and it works here. The thing is that there's a lot of great cinematography in this. There's a lot of great cinema tricks.
I'm waiting for you to say soundtrack.
Oh, well, the soundtrack is a separate. The soundtrack is not good.
No, but the score is incredible.
The score is incredible. The score, of course, is done by Giorgio Moroder.
Yeah.
The fucking father, the motherfucking father of electronic music. Like, the guy who was like, hey, what if we took a computer?
It may not express good, but it's good.
No, it's not. But so the score is really good. The problem, though, is that, well, for one thing, We keep making a reference to Meet Me Halfway.
You don't like the Log Dog? Come on, get out of here.
I believe I just heard.
Hold on. Okay. That was the first half of a sentence. The song appears in the movie seven fucking times in three different ways.
I don't understand.
Yeah, because it's got the Moroder score doing the.
You've got the piano version of it. You've got a version where it's played like on a plucked guitar. And then, of course, they play the, you know, Kenny Loggins going, meet me halfway.
When Lars von Trier.
Across this guy.
Lars von Trier made the Five Obstructions and basically remade one film five different times. It was considered arty. I kind of think of this as the Five Obstructions of Meet Me Halfway, where they're recreating it in several different formats, and I think every single one of them works. And if I hear one more person talk about why this is not a good soundtrack, we are going to arm wrestle on this table now.
I'm obsessed now with the fact that that McLennan referred to him as the log dog. We were talking about this earlier. Like, you know, we're probably going to have to do whether it be a Patreon episode or one of these episodes, where we just do our top 10 favorite Kenny Loggins songs, our top 10 log dog songs from 80s movies, because he did like 20 or 30 of them.
And I'm pretty sure that he was also the like creative consultant on all of his music videos. They're like, oh, what are we going to do in this one? Kenny goes, I wear the shades, I have the beard,
and I look at the camera.
Welcome to the fucking danger zone.
Sometimes I'm waking up. Sometimes I'm going to bed.
Yeah, like, have you seen the Danger Zone video? It's just him in a hotel room with, like, open wooden shutters and, like, breezy. Like, it's like half Tony Scott. It's like the weirdest thing. And then if you watch, like, Over the Top, it's the fucking same thing again.
Yeah.
It's just like him periodically just looking at the camera, singing. And then, and then they just cut to some really intense arm wrestling.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's that, but it works. The soundtrack works so well, and I love every single song that's on it.
My wife got pretty annoyed that I kept counting. Like, I would just, like, announce the number of times that Meet Me Halfway would show up.
Were you drinking when you were watching?
That is something that probably also happened.
Okay. Because I feel like, and maybe you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but, like, if I'm at home or if, like, I'm at the theater, it doesn't really matter, but if I've chosen to imbibe in some sort of substance of pleasure, I feel like whenever I watch these kind of, like, overly earnest movies, like, you're
never say the phrase substance of pleasure again.
Put it back in the box.
I'm gonna look at square substance of pleasure into your eyes.
Throw it on the chuck box. Throw another one on the chuck box.
But whenever there are these, like, earnest kind of action movies, or these movies where you're like, I'm gonna watch this, like, manly thing, and then you watch it, and then that earnest creeps in, and then you just start to feel yourself welling with tears because you're like, maybe you're a little whiskey drunk, and you go, fuck you, movie, you shouldn't be doing this to me.
It just. I just think there is a version of Meet Me Halfway for all occasions.
There is, and this movie has all of them.
Meet Me Halfway. My wife just died. Meet Me Halfway.
Yeah, no. They play it slowly on the piano when she dies. Like, that's the
that is steal
the,
your phone
the
and just make that my ringtone and then call you all the time now.
Yeah, do that. Please do that.
Done.
I do love the fact that when you get to the end, because they went with sort of a documentary style, and they populated that cast with professional wrestlers, and I can't believe saying this, actual professional arm wrestlers.
Professional wrestlers. We haven't mentioned the fact that Terry Funk's in this movie.
Yeah.
Terry Funk is in this fucking movie.
Yeah.
And it's like, wait a second, Terry Funk is just the bodyguard just because he's fucking Terry Funk.
Like, they doubled down on a lot of things in this movie. Like, they doubled down on the soundtrack, they doubled down on the Stallone, and like, this movie, and I don't think people really remember it, like, you can go on YouTube and look up old commercials, but, like, you could get your own arm wrestling table for kids, you could get your own action figures, you could do an action figure table where your action figures would arm wrestle. Like, they put a lot of money into, like, marketing, like, merchandising, like, everything on this movie, and it didn't really pan out.
And to quote someone in the movie, they had no shittin' business doing that, because this is really not that kind of movie, and unfortunately was one of the, I think you could call this one of the three films that kind of ended up toppling canon, because canon's whole model was, we're going to spend very little money, make a bunch of movies, hopefully one of them will be a marginal hit, we can then take that money and make 12 more movies. This was one of the first times when they went, we're going to spend $25 million on one movie, most of that going directly to Stallone. And it ended up between that and between another movie we're definitely going to cover this summer. Just
Masters of the Universe?
Oh, yeah. Ugh. The House of Cards came tumbling down. So, yeah.
Summer of 87 is an amazing year.
Didn't Frank Langella say that that's one of his favorite performances ever?
He's so good in it! We'll get there.
Calm down. We're still in the, this is the stuff that came out before the summer month, before we actually get into the summer.
We're still sifting through Chuck Pile A before we get to Chuck Pile
B. Stop trying to make Chuck Pile happen. Chuck Pile's never going to happen.
Chuck Pile will always happen.
Chuck Pile in the Chuck Pile.
Throw the Chuck Pile in the Chuck Pile. It took me a long time and multiple viewings to figure out why I love this dumb fucking movie as much as I absolutely do. Because
tell us, that's what this podcast's about. I would like to know, because I liked this movie, but dear God, have you been fighting for this movie a long time?
I love this movie, and I've loved this movie since the first time I saw it, and I still like thought it was dumb, but I love the hell out of it. And it's one of those movies that I associate with the 80s. Like, for me, it's like, it's relevant to the sense that whenever anyone talks about movies of the 80s, it's one of the first ones I think of. But I also figured something else out that made it even more personally relevant for me. This is kind of the ultimate stepdad movie, because Stallone, even though he is the biological father of Mike, he is so far removed from being a parent that he has to come at it this really bizarre outside angle. And he really pushes the idea of, like, this is what it means to be a man. You got to be a man, and I'm going to teach you. But the way he goes about that is, like, I'm going to teach you how to arm wrestle and gamble. And it's like, to me, it's like that stereotypical stepdad thing where it's like, you're going to learn to be, here's some beer and some cigarettes and don't tell your mom. And, you know, this is how you're going to.
No, but for every one of those, he's also got like a, hey, you can fall asleep on my shoulder.
Yes, because he is really sincerely trying, but it's like a really misguided attempt to like teach this kid.
Right, but like, I'm not a plumber, but if something broke underneath my sink, I would go there with whatever tools I had. And all he was doing was going like, yo, Mike, I'm all thumbs whenever it comes to this emotional shit, but I can teach you how to arm wrestle, work out while you're driving.
We're going to go to truck stops. You want to go to truck stops, Mike? Yeah, we're going to go to truck stops
for
dinner.
That's all he's got.
Got a great steak.
That's all he's got.
Yeah, no, but that's the thing is that what he's desperately trying to do, and what I think really does work about the emotional arc of this movie, is he's just trying to break this rich boy pretension out of his son and bring his son down to earth. Like, he doesn't care ultimately what his son does with his life, as long as his son doesn't end up like his grandfather, as long as he doesn't end up a rich asshole looking down his nose at everybody. He wants him to be somebody who takes care of himself, because that's who he is. He is somebody, he is this salt of the earth guy. He's the type of guy you expect that doesn't owe a cent in the world to anybody, because as soon as he owes somebody,
because he doesn't file taxes.
Because, well, he's somebody, you get the impression that he works his ass off to pay that back, because he doesn't want to owe the world shit. And he doesn't think the world owes him shit. And that he's just this self-starting guy. And he's looking at this son who looks down his nose at this fucking guy and looks down his nose at this lifestyle. And is like, and he's like, that's no son of mine is going to look down on another human being. Like, that's, and that's what he's going to do. He does, at the end of the day, he doesn't care. He doesn't, I mean, he wants his son to love him, but that's not the point. The point is who his son becomes rather than how his son views him, and that's how he earns his son's love, because his son finally cracks and gets that and is like, this is all that my dad wants. My dad wants me to be a good dude, and that's all I ever wanted out of a dad, is a dad who gives a shit about me.
Kind of back to Brian's point, like, maybe is like the facilitator for why people do have this like kind of unnatural love. Like, the 80s were like the post 50s world where like divorce is now an acceptable thing, and so many 80s kids are dealing with stepdads or broken homes. And then like, you watch a movie like this and like you've watched your blood sports and everything at that point, and then you watch like a movie like Over the Top and you go, I wish that was my dad.
Yeah,
like, that guy's so great.
Yeah, no, that's exactly, this is the reconnecting with your dad movie that works in this vein.
I mean, I don't want to plug anything, but whenever Guardians of the Galaxy 2 was announced for May for the Alamo Drafthouse, I decided to program Over the Top. That was just serendipitous that you guys asked me to come on around that time, because I was like, father-son movie, father-son Over the Top. This is my opportunity to show Over the Top.
Over the Top and Frequency.
oh, for sure, Over the Top. That's a great double feature.
Oh, yeah. Talk about reconnecting with your dad movies.
That's a double feature that your dad suddenly gets a phone call at 1 o'clock in the morning just because.
Oh, no, that's...
Hey, what's going on?
You up?
First time you watch...
you up. Don't say, yeah, you up to your dad. Nitro, box.
My dad's dead. I don't know how to relate to people.
Chuck Wild.
But, no, you're right. I was thinking about something you said earlier about how the 80s were really about Stallone playing... you know, everyday guys, everyday, just Joes.
He's a dock worker.
But I was just thinking about one of my favorite movies of his period, and it just happens to start off his 80s, is Nighthawks.
Yeah.
Where he is such, like, the regular...
Nighthawks is a fucking, like, excellent movie.
Look at Nighthawks versus Cobra and the type of cop that he plays, though. Nighthawks is, like, is his Popeye Doyle to, like, Cobra's... Well, RoboCop.
Yeah, I mean, Cobra is the leanest movie that exists. Like, it is purely... They're like, hey, what's runtime for a feature? And they're like, oh, it's got to be at least 88 minutes. It goes, done. Okay, I'm just going to fucking kill things and fight all the time. That's
it. Okay, 88 minutes, 10 minutes of that is going to be clanging axes together. 10 more minutes is going to be a robot photo shoot.
And then 10 seconds of cutting a pizza in half with scissors.
I think that movie is kind of like a unique, like, proto, like, for where he was going to go with stuff. Because, yeah, you do watch, like, almost any, like, Rambo is kind of like a down-on-his-luck everyman who is put in these, like, unreasonable circumstances, and then, like, you're fighting for that guy.
Yeah, no, Rambo becomes a superhero in the sequels, kind of like Rocky does, but Blood is just about a veteran who's got PTSD and people won't stop fucking with it. Yeah.
Well, it's the John McClane syndrome, where, you know, the whole point of John McClane, he was an everyman who's in a situation he can't handle, and then by the fifth movie. He's fucking tap dancing on the wing of fucking airplanes. Yeah. And you're like, what the fuck is this happy horse shit?
Yeah, it makes you think that if they'd made like five sequels to The Man Who Knew Too Much, by the fifth one, Jimmy Stewart would be in space. It's just, you take that Everyman and you just keep expanding that concept out too far. Your reach exceeds your grasp, and suddenly you're tap dancing on the wing of an F-16 because you've forgotten how to be a normal man. But yeah, truck drivers, you know, gritty cops, vets. Yeah, like that. This is Stallone. Like cab drivers. He was a fucking cab driver who wants to be a country singer in one of his movies in the 80s.
I fucking love that movie.
Oh, right? God.
Have you rewatched that movie as like an adult man?
Yes.
It's so fun. Like, I think maybe my girlfriend made me a big old softie for Dolly Parton, but man,
Rhinestone is not a good movie.
Where he fucking swings for the fences, and he doesn't give a shit that, like, he is the butt of the joke. And the best part about it is, like, you know Stallone, the actor, knows he's playing the butt of the joke, but he plays that character who is oblivious to it, and it's so great.
I haven't seen it as an adult man. I tried watching it once as a professional woman, and I couldn't really get into the mindset, so I'll have to give that another shot.
You're more of a 9-to-5 type?
Yeah, I am more of a, more of a 9-to-5 type. But another thing you mentioned, I thought about this too while I was watching it, is that this really is like class warfare at work.
Oh, yeah.
Like the way, and this is, I feel like, because Menachem Golan kind of came from nothing and was a self-made man and like started up his own company here in the States when he, you know, was releasing movies in Israel. And you do kind of see that in this movie where every choice that Robert Loggia makes is basically just like, I'm rich and I get what I want no matter what. I mean, the...
Which one was Robert Loggia again?
The grandfather.
Oh, I just wanted you to go, you're a bum.
You're a bum, Lincoln. You sell drugs. I don't know what you do, but you drive a truck, so you must be bad. And it really is. I think the Donald Trump thing I said before is kind of apt because it's like this hatred for just like people who have everything. And it's like Over the Top is a title that not only refers to the arm wrestling technique, but it's like there's a wall between the classes, Mike, and you got to get over that wall. And that's what I'm trying to teach you. That's why you're going to go to the arm wrestling championships in Las Vegas. It's still just, I want to, if this is still a thing, guys, get at me on Twitter. If you know that this is still a thing.
Oh, it is. No, it's funny. I actually got an email from a championship arm wrestling group that was going to be doing a tour.
Of course you did.
And they wanted to see if we could do over-the-top screenings at all Alamos across the country where we would host an arm wrestling expo in order to drum up excitement for arm wrestling.
I don't know how you put a finger on someone's mouth in an email, but I just imagine going, shh, you had me at Over-the-Top.
Oh, no, I was ready to do it. It just didn't work out. Broke my heart. I was like, guys, we should do this. And people were like, what are you talking about? And I was like, let's do this thing. And
for the 30th anniversary of Over the Top.
Well, that's something that I wanted to ask you. So you have an appreciation for this movie now. And obviously, like, you respect a lot of parts of it if you don't overall like the movie. So what did you think of this movie 25 years ago?
Oh, I didn't like it. Like, and I remember disliking it. I remember, you know, keep in mind that, you know, as a kid in the 80s and you're jazzed up for a fucking Stallone movie, and it's like, this is a movie where he's gonna fucking arm wrestle, and you watch that trailer, it's like, it's arm wrestling, and then it's an hour of driving around in a truck with a whiny bitch of a kid. Like, you just, I mean, you just hate him, and being the same age as that kid, you know, when the movie came out, it was one of those things where you just, like, whiny asshole, fucking Stallone is your dad, shut the fuck up, and just fucking...
He's got a solo flex in the truck!
Yeah.
What more do you want?
And so
the truck stops every night for dinner.
And then, of course, when you're a kid, you're not really, you know, reading into the subtext, because this, you need to read to the subtext to figure out what the fuck is going on, why he left. Like, why did dad leave? They never fucking really tell you. Yeah. They just kind of say, well, I had to leave. It was a mistake. I should have never done it. And it's like, but what, you know, clearly he's still in love with his wife. Like, what was, you get an impression that had to do with the grandfather, but it's like, why aren't you telling us that? And then you finally get to the arm wrestling and it's over what, as soon as it starts, like, it's just like bam. And
you want to sucker like as a 12-year-old for like the third act, like Weepers, where it's just like a triumphant freeze frame. By that point, you're just like, nope, you got me.
Yeah, it just didn't work for me when I saw it. But and keep in mind, like, this is in the same era where there are a bunch of competition movies that at the time I felt were significantly better, because of course I was a kid and didn't realize how bad many of those Van Damme movies were.
The best, the entire series was a favorite of mine growing up.
Well, as you and and I talked about, like, our favorite Van Damme movie is actually Lionheart.
Lionheart's amazing.
It is. It's, you know, it's the best of those movies. But of course, that was also later in his career.
Also starring Story By.
Yes. Another one of those where he had his hand in making it. And another blue-collar, you know, kind of reconnection movie. And
the most blue-collar, I think, of all of Van Damme's
No,
movies.
I mean, admittedly, he does run away from the Legionnaires 5 times.
That's a point that you made. But no, it warms my heart. I'm as proud of you, Cargill, for coming around on this movie as if I were Lincoln Hawk watching Mike use the Soloflex in the truck. It's just it warms my heart.
It's not quite the turnaround that I had on Tombstone,
but it's close.
But it is. Yeah, no, it's I no longer dislike this movie. In fact, I admire some parts to it. And there are the things that you can enjoy, like that some of the music in this movie is so bad that it's hard not to love how awful some of this music is.
And no matter, and this is the real triumph of this movie, is how triumphant that last arm wrestling. I'm going to say this again. That last arm wrestling match is like it's like a good documentary. A good documentary can make you interested in a subject you have no interest in prior. As silly as this movie is, as a
spelling bees.
Fuck yeah, spelling bees. Are you kidding me?
Oh, fuck. You want to talk about things you ordinarily wouldn't give a shit about that you love? Cutting Edge.
Come on. I grew up with the Cutting Edge.
Yeah. But this movie is, to a certain degree, the Cutting Edge in that, you know, he's got the Kroshenko maneuver, you know, that thing that he does, but he doesn't do it all the time. You're like, why isn't he going over the top? Why isn't he just lost the, of course he did. He didn't use the maneuver. And then finally it's like, because they're saving it for the final fight.
So between that, between Stallone's sincerity, this awesome soundtrack, the way it's shot, and the fact that they go to great lengths. This movie explains to you, it holds your hand through this whole competition, reminding you, ladies and gentlemen, please, for the love of God, remember, this is a double elimination tournament. Yeah, yeah. You have to lose twice to be like, they go through the rules better than fucking Invictus did. By the end of Invictus, I was like, I don't know what that scoreboard means. I don't play rugby. You're not explaining anything to me. Is this dramatic? I don't know. Are they winning? Are they losing? Like, what? I don't. How many more downs do they have? I don't get it. This movie is like, I'm going to. There's nothing to arm wrestling, but we'll explain all the rules anyway. We'll explain to you why there are 12 referees in an arm wrestling match. Don't worry about that. I mean, they really do, like, get you involved to the point that you're like, have I liked arm wrestling my whole life?
And to the credit of the filmmakers, and I guess less so to the screenwriters, but to put, like, that Jimmy Buffer in that room constantly really lends excitement to things that were over in less than 1 second.
A lot of slow motion.
And Gollum managed to, like, wring every ounce of excitement of two guys arm wrestling for a finale. And, like, the whole time you're like, oh, shit! Well, like, you actually watch that with, like, anticipation and, like, stress.
Well, the way that sequence is shot is actually really fantastic. How they shoot it low and make you feel like you're actually, like, standing in the chaos of all this. Yeah. And
plus, it makes the combatants feel like they're, like, 50 feet tall.
Yeah, no, it was really well executed the way they do that. Like, that is a fascinating thing to watch. You would think watching an arm wrestling competition would be boring. And no, they really do ratchet it up in all the right ways to make it just a phenomenal event that you're watching.
So I have to go around the room before we finish. Best arm wrestling movie or best arm wrestling movie? What do we think?
That's a tough one, but I'm going to go with best arm wrestling movie.
I would agree. Best arm wrestling movie.
Yeah, best arm wrestling movie.
He said it. You can't take it back now.
Can't take it back. No gives his backsies.
The world meets nobody halfway. Remember that.
And that brings us to the junk food pairing, which this one was super easy, not just because Greg is here from the Alamo, but because it is one of the things I most wish they would bring back to their menu.
Oh my, the over-the-top dog.
The over-the-top dog!
I can't spoil anything, but I'm just saying, like, it has nothing to do with over-the-top, but you might be satisfied soon.
Is this like the thing where you said you should really come to the fourth Cage marathon and then you got fucking Nicolas Cage?
Yeah, the guy who invented hot dogs is going to be hand-serving them out to everybody.
I don't give a shit if Nicolas Cage is there. Just tell me that fucking hot dog is coming back, Greg. Stop teasing me!
I don't remember, but I do remember seeing an email where there is a hot dog special coming up.
I care
as much
about
the one with the mac and cheese pizza with hot dogs on it?
No. It is a standalone dog, I believe.
The over-the-top dog was literally just a hot dog. I actually have the I found the old description from the menu that I want to read you right now.
You're a man who cares about a hot dog.
You should.
I do.
Like, I don't want to bust your balls here, but like, you can go to a 7-Eleven and get a shitty hot dog.
Are you going to... Well, no, don't meet him halfway.
Don't meet me halfway. It is a quarter-pound all-beef dog on a toasted hoagie with mustard, ketchup, and relish on the side. That is the most basic description of a hot dog, but does nothing to sum up how great this dog is. Much like the description that Cargo read at the beginning of the show of this movie, does nothing to describe to you how great a movie Over the Top is and how satisfying it is. And if you don't deliver on this promise to bring back Over the Top Dog, I swear to God, we're gonna right now. Let's go.
We'll do it.
Get the strap, Cargo. Get the strap.
I like the fact that this is programming for the Alamo Draft House. People think I run the kitchen.
No, you do. You do. Because I said
no, but you know the guy who knows the guy who runs the kitchen.
Yeah, you're like like Henry Hill, like walking through the back to get to the theater.
I've been tight with the chefs, and I'm like, hey guys, just between you and me, can we bring the nachos back? And they're like, hey buddy, it's out of my hands. And I was like, fair enough.
Whose hands is it in?
Yeah, how did you not have nachos for Colossal? How did you not have Colossal nachos?
We have nachos. For Colossal.
Well, good. I need to go have them.
We have them. And there was short beef rib on the top.
Oh, that sounds delightful.
Beef short rib.
Hey, Greg, where can people find you online?
You guys can find me at The McLennan. That's MacLennan for all of you misspellers out there. Just follow me there, and I'll always keep you up to date with what's going on with Neon, where we're releasing a bunch of movies right now.
What do you have out right now, Neon?
We have Colossal, the new Nacho Vigalondo movie starring Anne Hathaway and Jason Sudeikis and Dan Stevens.
Which is one of my favorite movies that I saw last year. I love it.
We got Risk, the new Laura Poitras movie who directed Citizen 4 coming out. We have Ingrid Goes West with Aubrey Plaza coming out. Well, there's a whole bunch of good stuff. And yeah, if you follow me on Twitter, rest assured, I will remind you every time they're coming out. And then I guess the most exciting thing that I'm working on is I just announced on my Twitter today on June 4th, I'm going to be bringing out WrestleMania 2.
Yeah!
The
WrestleMania 2.
To the Kurt Russell Mega Marathon, which is going to be 5 mystery 35mm prints of Kurt Russell movies. You don't know what they are. You should not give a shit what they are, because I guarantee you every single one of them will star the one, the only true God, Kurt Russell.
I love it. That's actually the first WrestleMania is where I discovered Breakdown, and I've not stopped talking about
that
movie.
Best thing Jonathan Mostow ever did.
Yes, this is true. Sorry, Terminator 3. So, Greg, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Every time I get to come on and bullshit about movies that I love because nobody I know ever wants to talk to me about them anymore is the best thing in the world, and I'm so flattered to be back.
Awesome. Cargo, where can people find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at Massawyrm. That's MassawyrM. On Facebook, facebook.com/Massawyrm.
Awesome. You can find me on Twitter at Bry Guy Salisbury. We are at Junk Food Cinema. You can also like us on Facebook, facebook.com/Junk Food Cinema. iTunes, please, those reviews and those 5-star ratings, really appreciate those. Please keep those coming in. And if you really like the show, use our Amazon links. Go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. Throw a few shekels in the hat. Little as $4 a month. All this bonus content. It is insane. But I'm gonna wrap up the show reminding you kids that winner takes it all, loser takes the fall. But life actually might be double elimination, so feel free to have another over-the-top dog.